This is Unanimous Dissent, broadcasting from the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. We are the District Sentinel. I'm Sam Sachs.
And I'm Sam Knight. Coming up, the Iran deal didn't get a great amount of attention during the presidential campaign, but it got some this week from a top Obama administration official. We'll bring you up to speed just shortly.
And Congressman Keith Ellison's bid to be the DNC chair is coming under assault from smear artists on the right, the left, and the weird. Staff writer at Jezebel, Brendan O'Connor, joins us to break down those forces that are taking aim at the guy who's got the best chance of turning around the Democratic Party.
Plus, it's Friday. That means someone's going in the garbage can at the end of the show.
What up?
We've got plenty of can-worthy nominees, garbage candidates, if you will, from people in Trump's inner circle to a group of 20 House Democrats. Stick around until the end of the show if you want to know who will be wiping banana peels and dirty diapers off their face.
I cannot wait for that. But first, could it be that congressional Republicans are already starting to get cold feet about their sweeping right-wing agenda? A couple of interesting tidbits of information circulating around the D.C. media suggest there's disagreement within the GOP Congress over just how boldly or how bold they should be now that they're in control of both chambers of Congress and will be in control of the White House come January, late January. We've got The Hill, which is reporting that several House Republicans are raising red flags about the GOP's repeal and delay plan for Obamacare in the first 100 days of Donald Trump's presidency. Now, this refers to the strategy being discussed among congressional leadership, Republicans, to repeal the Affordable Care Act using something called budget reconciliation. It's a process where Republicans would only need a simple majority, 51 votes, to pass things. They could get around any attempts by Democrats to filibuster an Obamacare repeal by using the reconciliation process. And, you know, once Obamacare is repealed, according to this plan, Republicans would get to work crafting a replacement, assuming that's really what they're interested in. But as The Hill notes, moderate Republicans are, quote, getting skittish about leadership's plan to replace the sprawling health care law within about a year of Trump's inauguration, because that would run too close to the 2018 midterms. You know, we have elections every 2 years, and during those years, you can't pass any legislation, apparently, because it's too close to the midterms.
Can't have lawmakers being judged on making laws, can you?
No, of course not. One lawmaker was quoted as saying, quote, it's going to be technical, all the insurance stuff, it's hard work putting that in play, but that's the beginning of the next election cycle. Republicans are worried that once they repeal the Affordable Care Act using only 51 votes or whatever, then they will have a difficult time replacing the Affordable Care Act without Democratic buy-in, which is almost certain to happen. Not happen, I should say. They're going to have a hard time getting Democratic buy-in on creating a healthcare alternative once the Affordable Care Act is repealed. And that could prove to be a liability when those midterms come along. Republican Congressman Tom Cole told The Hill, quote, we know we can do a lot of repeal through reconciliation, but you can't do replace through reconciliation. And he added that working with Democrats on a replacement would be one of Republicans' toughest issues. Quote, there will be a lot of drama with this over the next year. And none of this, of course, should be taken as a sign that we should treat the threat of Republican rule lightly. There's no question in my mind that they're going to try to jam through a bunch of reactionary garbage. But the internal disagreements suggest that they're not quite thinking all of this through in a way that they should. The same is true of their plans to overhaul Medicare and Medicaid, or privatize parts of those programs, at least. Politico reports that the GOP's dream of privatizing parts of Medicare is running up against resistance among Senate Republicans. Paper adds that interviews with more than a dozen GOP lawmakers reveal that they're not planning to pursue big changes to the popular health care program for seniors, at least not in the first year of the Trump administration. So sorry, Paul Ryan. The chairman of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, Republican Lamar Alexander, said between trying to repeal Obamacare, and everything else the GOP has planned, there are just too many thorny issues already on the agenda without even trying to privatize Medicaid or Medicare. It would, quote, fall in the category of biting off more than we can chew, Alexander said.
Yeah, Republicans must think now more than before that they can't alienate, or at least they can't overtly alienate the working class.
I mean, I know Trump got elected with a bunch of rich people who want to see this sort of stuff, the same traditional Republicans that want to see this sort of stuff. But what put him over the top?
Yeah. I mean,
were working class people who did not vote for their Medicare or Medicaid to be privatized.
Yeah, it's not true at all that Trump voters tended to be more working class than Hillary voters. But according to an exit poll conducted by the AFL-CIO, Trump did gain in union households and with union members compared to how Mitt Romney did in 2012. And that really kind of closed the gap on the presidential level. And this was, remember, the November election came down to only a few 10,000 votes or so. So the skittishness makes a lot of sense, especially too when considering the waves being made in the labor movement and the Democratic Party. The AFL-CIO was recently asked to hold off on endorsing Ellison for DNC, we noted on the show, by Labor Secretary Tom Perez, who's the preferred candidate of the Obama White House. And it did for a bit, but appears to be moving forward. In an email to executive council members about an endorsement, the AFL-CIO asked if it should tout Ellison, or the only other option was not supporting any other candidate. So Ellison or nobody. And as we've noted,
tails everybody else loses.
As we've noted, Ellison has racked up endorsements from progressive outsiders, Democratic brass, and leaders in the party more to the left, like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. So Republicans must surely be wary of enacting a Paul Ryan-style agenda in that context, and they should be, as the last election was not so much a win for Republicans as it was a loss for Hillary Clinton and a victory for what was perceived as populism, something that most elected Republicans couldn't manage to muster if their lives depended on it.
Yeah.
If you told a GOP, your average GOP congressman, put down the shrimp cocktail or you're going to walk the plank, buddy, they're going to shove that shrimp straight into their mouth.
Buddy, they won't even let me eat the shrimp here. All right, more on Congressman Keith Ellison and his bid to be the DNC chair later when we speak with Brendan O'Connor of Jezebel. For another story here, though, we have to step into the SCIF. It's our version of the soundproof room for our classified session.
We need to get into classified session.
Okay, so let's talk about the Iran deal.
Let's talk about it.
Let's have a little banter. CIA Director John Brennan gave an interview to the BBC, which was released Wednesday, and he warned Donald Trump that killing the Iran nuclear deal, as Trump has promised, would be, quote, disastrous and, quote, the height of folly. For one administration to tear up an agreement the previous administration made would be almost unprecedented, is what Brennan told the Beeb. Then it could lead to a weapons program inside of Iran that could lead other states in the region to embark on their own programs. I would add that this scenario would also embolden hawks in the Republican Party and those among U.S. allies in the region, Israeli, Saudi Arabia, looking at you guys. Though Israel would be unable to embark on its own weapons program since it already did that decades ago, of course. Brennan not exactly being forthright by suggesting the Middle East is currently free of nuclear weapons.
No, he's not.
Either way, he's certainly correct to surmise the scrapping of the deal would heighten the risk of confrontation and further nuclear proliferation. And it seems something rather likely under Trump, given his rumored choices for Secretary of State, his top two being Mitt Romney and Rudy Giuliani. Even David Petraeus, another name in the running. It would increase probability of the deal being scuttled given an August 2015 op-ed on the matter in which Petraeus said that the Iran deal could be made workable by giving Israel 30,000-pound bombs and working with Israel and the Gulf monarchies to counter Hezbollah. Yeah, no better way to counteract those negative traits of the brutal Iranian government than by helping the Saudi monarchs and the United States apartheid state buddy, I guess. But extremely good. In the same op-ed, by the way, Petraeus said Iran shouldn't be trusted with any civilian nuclear material because it doesn't act like normal state actors because it's on the United States state sponsors of terrorism list, which, as we noted yesterday, included Cuba until recently. So not exactly a reliable list.
No.
Bob Corker, who's the other guy still in the mix for the Secretary of State position, he's also been a vociferous critic of the rapprochement with Iran. So it's not looking good. Furthermore, Trump's choice for Secretary of Defense, which was just recently announced, retired General James Mad Dog Mattis. Earlier this year, he called Iran, quote, the single most enduring threat to stability and peace in the Middle East. And he's been consistently hawkish on how the U.S. should approach Tehran. I should note that in recent year, there were studies around the world polling people about which country represents the greatest threat to peace around the world. Majority, vast majority of people around the globe said the United States. Very, very few said Iran. I think it was just basically like the U.S., Israel, possibly Canada. Anyway, so yeah, it looks like the self-styled anti-intervention candidate has he's got the country on a collision course for confrontation, global confrontation. Never thought I would say this, but in this context, it makes sense. Sorry, John Brennan. Damn.
Yeah. I'm not willing to say sorry to John Brennan just yet, but I will say that we have had this Iran nuclear crisis thing like on hanging over all of our heads, like the sword of Damocles for decade now, you know, going back to the Bush administration. And this deal has kind of relieved a lot of that. I mean, there are skeptics still to the deal and everybody's saying that, you know, this isn't nearly sufficient and Iran can just break the deal. But like, that's not happening. Like, for the last year and a half or so, like, there's been sort of this, like, relief, this easement of tensions.
Yeah.
And it's a little distressing knowing that it can all just kind of go away just like that.
Yeah. I mean, especially when the deal was finalized and Obama administration officials were making the case for it, they pointed out quite correctly, I mean, you don't need an advanced understanding of international relations so much as you need to know how multilateralism works.
Yeah.
And the fact that the United States is not the only not the only country. The United States and Iran are not the only two countries in the world. And this deal was
the name of the deal is multi-country, multilateral. What was it?
Plan of Action, JCPOA. Yeah. And, you know, all five members of the UN Security Council. I never thought I would say this, but, you know, maybe it's good that, you know, the whole idea that Trump is like Putin's lapdog, maybe Putin can save the Iran deal, you know?
We'll see.
I mean, at this point, that's what we're looking at here, begging Vladimir Putin to save the Iran deal.
To, like, talk to Trump. Like, Trump was all about torture, and then he had a conversation with Mattis or something, and now he's not? Like, it's maybe someone will talk to him about
that's
the Iran
part
deal.
Of the problem is, Mattis doesn't seem like he's going to be the guy to talk Trump off this ledge.
Yes. Okay, we normally take listener calls at the end of the show, but this is Friday and we do our garbage can segment at the end of the show, of course. And I think this is a pretty important phone call to get to, one that we can't really afford to push off till next week. Earlier in the week, we talked about a guy who could be Trump's labor secretary, Andy Puzder. Puzder met with Trump last week. He's vying for a role in the administration. And as the American Prospect notes, Puzder is very much anti-labor. He's championed every aspect of right-wing trickle-down economics. He is against minimum wage increases. He's also the owner of the fast food chains Hardee's and Carl's Jr. Now, Sam and I caused a bit of a stir when we rejected Hardee's as a quality fast food restaurant. The two Sams, of course, being connoisseurs of fine fast food dining. We can make these judgments. And we promptly had Travis from Baltimore call into the show yesterday to inform us of how good Hardee's actually is. I think he touted a quadruple triple cheeseburger. Well, now we've got another caller.
Good. Yeah.
We've got another caller. And guess what? It's Jorts Authority, at Jorts Authority, who always calls into the show. I'm guessing he's going to call in to own me like he usually does. But I'm warning you this time, Jorts, tread lightly, my friend. Tread lightly. Play the message.
Light them up.
Hey, guys. Hi, Sam. It's your buddy, Jorts Authority, again. Hey, I was listening to your call-in segment on Thursday's show, And when Travis called in, he had mentioned how Hardee's is good, and I'm on Travis's side. I'm a red-blooded American man. I got hot blood pumping through my heart fast, and I have to agree, Hardee's is great. But then afterwards, you mentioned you didn't know some nebulous things about Carl's Jr. Well, Carl's Jr. is Hardee's. They are the same. They serve the same food. They have different names in different states. That you failed to note that on the show is why I'm calling. It's dangerous, especially in our current economic times and with President-elect Trump likely coming into office, for you to be I wouldn't say you're spreading disinformation, but you just didn't properly inform the public about Carl's Jr. And that's really upsetting. And frankly, Sam Knight, I'm really surprised at, considering our mutual appreciation for Tendies. Disappointed, guys. That's all I can really say. I guess have a great week.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Jorts, and for the owning, as usual. Only this time...
we did fact-checking.
You're the one about to get owned, Jorts. First, I did note on the radio show yesterday that I believed, I wasn't sure, but that I believed that Hardee's and Carl's Jr. are the same thing. In fact, I have the clip from yesterday's show. Please play it.
Travis, shockingly, his silence on Carl's Jr. speaks volumes.
Yeah, I think there might be, maybe they're the same thing. I don't know. It's whatever. Okay, did you hear that? Did you hear that?
Yeah.
I suggested they might be the same place. So hold your fire, Jorts. But here's the more important
There's more.
And we've brought on Eugene Puryear, the host of By Any Means Necessary, a great show. Everyone should listen to it. It airs Monday through Friday out of the Radio Sputnik studios here. Eugene, I understand you can settle this for us, can't you?
He wanted to. He really wanted to.
Are Hardee's and Carl's Jr. the same thing?
Hardee's and Carl's Jr. are not the same thing.
And how are they different?
Near and dear to my heart, Hardee's serves fried chicken. For whatever reason, Carl's Jr. on the West Coast refuses to serve fried chicken.
So
that sounds like a huge difference. That sounds like a major difference.
Not the same restaurants at all. So you got that, George? Did you hear it? Straight from Eugene Puryear and the Two Sams. Eat it. More dissent coming up. And welcome back to Unanimous Dissent. The Two Sams still here with you from Washington, D.C. And as our listeners know, the Two Sams have endorsed Congressman Keith Ellison to be the new chair of the Democratic National Committee.
We are the Two Sams, and we endorse this message.
It's a bid that looks pretty strong, I might add. He's got not just the support of the progressive wing of the party with Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. He also has the support of leadership in the party, including the incoming Senate Minority Leader, Chuck Schumer. But it's not going to be easy for Mr. Ellison, as he's quickly learning this week. He's now the subject of a smear campaign operated by your likely right-wing suspects, but also liberals and members of the news media. Joining us now with that story is Brendan O'Connor, reporter, staff writer at Jezebel. You can follow Brendan on Twitter at _Grendan.
_Grendan. Sorry.
Hey, Brendan. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, Brendan. I just want to apologize for my co-host mispronouncing _. It can be hard. Sometimes your mouth gets dry when you say a bunch of words.
Yeah.
It happens all the time.
It's all right, Sam. I won't call you out at all when you do it today for the rest of the show.
I dare you.
All right. So let's break down some of these forces that are working to smear Ellison. As you point out in your article over at Jezebel, we've got right-wing forces at work, as you'd expect, also known Islamophobes. Congressman Ellison is, of course, a Muslim. We've got Alan Dershowitz. Then my favorite, the K-Man, K-File, BuzzFeed Andrew diving into. Where should we start with all this?
Where should we start? Yeah, I mean, where to begin? I mean, I think really the genesis of all of this is really is what you would expect. The genesis is the kind of like right wing, super conservative, or not even super conservative, just anti-Muslim, Islamophobic sources that have been coming after Ellison like for over a decade. like that this is not new, and a lot of this has already been hashed out and litigated over and over again, but really came to hit the national level in 2006 when Ellison was first running for Congress. And it's been bubbling in this over the past few weeks, past few months on the right-wing blogosphere, as it were, and then yesterday really kind of hit the mainstream with this big, long story in CNN that Andrew Kaczynski did that I don't really think has necessarily any like explicit ideological bent to it. I think that it's just that Kaczynski and K-File and CNN just have this kind of like compulsive need to just like puke up everything that comes across their radar and just put it out there just because, you know, it's raising questions. People are talking about it.
So without lending too much credence to a lot of these things, I mean, Ellison himself has addressed a lot of these criticisms or past comments that he's made. What are some of the accusations against him, and how do they jive with his record as a congressman?
Right. So, I mean, the broad sweep of it is that it's raising vague questions about associations that he has made with known anti-Semites, and, you know, and nobody ever says, like, well, or everybody's very always clear to say, like, well, like, Ellison himself has never said anything anti-Semitic or anything bigoted or discriminatory, but he has these relationships. Okay, so, like, what are those relationships? So in the early 90s, as a young man in Minneapolis working as an attorney and a community organizer, Ellison, and he's been very forthcoming about this, Ellison helped to organize people from his community to go to D.C. for the Million Man March, which was organized by Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam, that was attended by a young Barack Obama and Maya Angelou and Rosa Parks and Jesse Jackson, all kind of like both existing shining lights of the civil rights movement and people whose stars were on the rise. I mean, Ellison, as a young man, definitely expressed solidarity with, I mean, that might even be overstating the case, but sympathy and interest in Black nationalist movements and in the kind of definitely more radical elements of the civil rights movement, which, you know, given the context both then and now, is understandable, I think, and like is a totally ahistorical move to condemn anyone for. But he subsequently has said, you know, like he has admitted that he is skeptical enough of people like Farrakhan and Farrakhan's right hand man, what's his name? Khalid Mohammed, came to their defense as a younger man when they were accused of being anti-Semitic, which I think it is fair to say that they were, but as a young man, Ellison has said, like, you know, like his reaction was, you know, this is once again like mainstream media and the white establishment trying to smear leaders in the Black community, which, fair enough. Like, we know that happens, that has happened, that is now it is happening again. And subsequently, he has said, well, in 2006, I think is like a really kind of incredible example of a way for a politician to like reconcile with past beliefs that they now repudiate. He, in a letter to the Jewish Community Relations Council of Minnesota in 2006, wrote, "I have a deep and personal aversion to anti-Semitism, regardless of its source, and I reject and condemn the anti-Semitic statements and actions of the Nation of Islam, Louis Farrakhan, and Khalid Mohammed." And he goes on, "I should have come to that conclusion earlier than I did. I regret that I didn't." Like, it's complicated, but I think he's owned up to it, and I think he's offered a nuanced understanding of how people's ideas evolve and their relationship with more radical ideas about how to critique the political establishment. And I think that, like, anyone who is trying to present this as a, like, straightforward Keith Ellison is secretly anti-Semitic is either disingenuous or an idiot.
In 2014, when Israel conducted its most recent widespread bombing campaign of Gaza and, you know, killed 2,000 or so civilians. Ellison was one of the few people in Congress who offered any sort of meaningful criticism of Israel, and he voted against emergency funding for Iron Dome. He was one of 8 members of Congress to do so. He helped sort of talk about the beating of Tariq Abu Qader, the 15-year-old Palestinian-American who was beaten by Israeli police in the West Bank around the time of the military campaign. But he's against BDS. He's for aid to Israel, but he's more in line with sort of younger Dems' skepticism of U.S. unconditional support for Israel, basically. Is that what sort of this criticism is kind of afraid of? You know, I mean, it seems to me that sort of Ellison as chair of the DNC, that would be the threat to those sort of mainstream interests and sensibilities.
Right, yeah. So I do think that's why organizations like the Anti-Defamation League and Dershowitz and people who are not so explicitly aligned with like the broader, or don't necessarily fit into the broader, like, or what we think of as the right wing movement, are picking this up and running with it, is because, yeah, like Ellison, he is on the left wing of the Democratic Party when it comes to most things, and yes, and when it comes to Israel and Palestine in particular, I think that he's still within like the party framework. Like, he's not a there are plenty of people who are to the left of Ellison on this issue.
Absolutely. I've seen him get a lot of flack, you know, from pro-Palestine activists for not supporting BDS, for example.
Right. But to your point, in the case of ADL and their sort of flip-flopping and equivocating on their support for him, yeah, I mean, I think that my understanding is that they are worried about losing. I mean, ADL is a nonprofit organization, and so they're dependent on outside contributions, and that they're worried about after a presidential campaign when they did come out in some instances in pretty critical ways against Trump and some of his appointments and some of the rhetoric that has been deployed by him and his surrogates, that now they're worried about losing conservative money, and that if the concern there is that if Ellison is in a position of leadership within the Democratic Party, that is going to change the landscape in terms of where is the Israel-Palestine issue fit in American politics, which is concerning for those people.
Yeah, the ADL has come under fire from the right for criticizing Trump aide Steve Bannon, white nationalist, a guy who didn't want his kids to go to school with Jews, according to divorce papers filed by his ex-wife. Bannon was also arrested for beating her in 1996. Do you think this story has currency in part due to that age-old hackish, like Politico-style both sides sort of ism, I guess, an effort to link someone on the left of the Democratic Party to the right of the GOP with just no sort of critical thought?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry, that's a bit of a leading question, I guess.
Yeah, no, I don't think there's any question that impulse is something that people on the right are exploiting. They're like, okay, so we're talking about this prominent Republican who, like, there are these accusations of anti-Semitism. Well, what about Keith Ellison? Like, and that is, like I said before, I think that that's very disingenuous.
I mean, Dershowitz did that, the what about Keith Ellison thing, basically in the early days, in the early hours of the Bannon controversy, too.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what is even to say about that other than that it is indicative of an impulse in, I guess, like the way that mainstream media works, and especially broadcast media, to just like that, like there's this, the space is open for people to change the conversation, like from what they like what people actually want to talk about. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like these things are not equivalent. This is a false equivalence, and like that is seems very clear to me. And yet there are venues in which this equivalence is able to be made, and not just on CNN. Like on that conversation with Dershowitz was on MSNBC.
Right.
Lean forward, baby.
And I think that the Anti-Defamation League, they changed their position on Ellison after a story came out written by a guy whose organization has been called out by the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Yes, right.
So they're taking their cues from there.
Yeah, I mean, ADL turned tail yesterday after the story on CNN, and then they specifically cited an audio clip that was released by the Investigative Project on Terrorism, which was founded in 1995 by a guy named Steve Emerson, who is the guy that was propagating this idea of the no-go zones that are, you know, popping up all over Europe, and specifically said that in London, Muslim religious police are beating people for not wearing religious Muslim attire.
I lived in East London one summer. That wasn't true when I was there, just for the record.
Well, yeah, and Prime Minister David Cameron, or former Prime Minister David Cameron...
called
this dude clearly a complete idiot. And yeah, and
he wasn't wrong about that, Diamond Dave.
And the SPLC has cited Emerson as a notorious Islamophobe and conspiracy theorist. And yeah, and so this is the person that the ADL, this is the source that the ADL is used as a reason to justify the fact that they have flip-flopped on their support for Ellison.
That's extremely good and cool of them.
So what are, just to kind of, I guess, close this all out, what are we to make of Chuck Schumer's unwavering support for Ellison? When Schumer first backed Ellison, I cynically thought that Schumer was doing it just to deflect any lefty opposition that might arise to his bid to be minority leader in the Senate. But, you know, Schumer's still sticking with Ellison, even as groups like the ADL are ditching him. And he's been very vocal about it. He put out a strong statement in support yesterday, this week. Could this suggest that Schumer intends to run the Senate in a way that adheres to lefties in the party like Ellison and Sanders?
I mean, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I have to say I was pleasantly surprised to see not just that Schumer is remaining committed to Ellison, but that his statement was as unequivocal as it was. Whether or not that means that he is going to, as you say, run the party in the Senate in a way that kind of adheres to what the Ellison, Sanders, Warren wing wants to see, I mean, that remains to be seen. I think that it is a positive sign.
It's kind of a relief to me because when other Sam was away on vacation, I went on a little rant. I did my impression of him, and I was sort of pleading with people to give Chuck Schumer a bit of a chance because he has seen the writing on the wall before in terms of, like, you know, the bigger picture about what the Democratic Party's message needs to be, even if he's been typically sort of pretty awful on foreign policy stuff, that he he seems to grasp the turning tide that is basically about to drown us all.
I leave the show one day and you turn it into like Blue Nation Review over here.
Whoa. My first me on the air.
In 100 episodes.
These neo-libs are just taking over.
Brendan, real quick, before we let you leave, does it look like any of this smear campaign is gaining traction to like derail, I mean, at least to derail Ellison's bid who at least looked like it was going to be comfortable for him?
Well, yeah. I mean, yesterday with the piece in CNN, I mean, that was, I think, a pretty significant development. I mean, I was aware of this smear campaign, but before yesterday, it was kind of more or less limited to like right-wing media. And so it getting this much traction on CNN and then prompting this flip from ADL, I mean, the answer to your question is yes. Like, clearly it is gaining traction. The fact, though, that Schumer has not been swayed by this would definitely, like, that's kind of key, I think. Like, if Schumer had not supported Ellison, that could have been lights out. But the fact that he's sticking by him. I mean, I don't know. We'll see what happens.
Well, the two Sams are sticking by him.
Yes.
The two Sams haven't. He hasn't lost the two Sams, but that's pretty hard to do at this point. Brendan O'Connor, reporter, staff writer at Jezebel. Follow Brendan on Twitter at _Grendan with a G. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Brendan. You're a good boy.
Thanks, guys.
More Dissent coming up. Unanimous Dissent still here with you. Still broadcasting out of the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight.
We are the District Sentinel news team, and you can read all of our latest reports over at www.districtsentinel.com. Well, we've made it to the end of another week.
Barely.
Yeah, barely. And, you know, we didn't do a garbage can last week. It was Thanksgiving, we decided to...
We did a thankful can.
Yeah, we did a thankful can. We decided to talk about all the things we were thankful for, including all our listeners.
Quite frankly, it made me sick.
Yeah, and I guess what I'm getting at is here, we're long overdue for a freaking garbage can. We've got a lot of garbage candidates to get through. So, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, gender nonconforming people of all ages, it's time for the garbage can. And here it comes.
I can smell it.
Ah. Oh, yeah. There's that pungent smell I've missed.
Oh, it's like, did you ever go on a family road trip and then one of your parents farts and they won't admit it? They're like, at the windows
they
up.
Just like casually put the window down for a little bit?
If at all.
If at all.
Yeah, that's where we are.
I was out of D.C. last week.
Yeah.
And I was in the Midwest, and there were times where I thought I caught a whiff of the garbage can all the way out there. It's so darn stinky. Might have just been the Midwest, but I think it was the garbage can.
Wow, coastal elitism.
Well, flyover country here. Hi, I'm Josh Barrow. Okay.
Are you going in the can?
I'm nominating myself for the can for that, but there are a bunch of other candidates who will likely beat me out this week. All right, let's get on with it. Garbage candidate number one, Mitt Mother Effin' Romney. All right, look, I don't want to spoil things, but I think Mitt Romney is going in the garbage can this week. This guy has chased the dollar his whole life, was a jerk all the way back to his high school days. Like, there's that story of him holding someone down and, like, shaving their head or something.
Yeah.
And this is a guy who strapped his dog onto the roof of his car. What was the dog's name?
Seamus.
Seamus. Right on the top of his car for a road trip.
Yeah.
So... Mitt Romney's been a bad guy, but he took one principled stand in his whole entire life. One principled stand. He did this one time in his whole damn life. It was when he stood up against Donald Trump. Mitt Romney gave that speech, you might remember. He called Trump's foreign policy, quote, dangerous and very, very not smart. He basically called Trump a liar. He said that Trump doesn't have the temperament to be president. He criticized Trump's business record, claimed that Trump was running a giant scam. Romney said, quote, he's playing the members of the American public for suckers. He gets a free ride to the White House. All we get is a lousy hat. He told NBC's Chuck Todd later, quote, is someone with his record and someone who believes the things he believes, which in my view would lead to a recession and to a trade war and would lead to a world being less safe. Do we want that person to be president of the United States? Do we, Mitt? Again, this marked the first time that Mitt did something principled. And guess what? He's quickly running away from it. Mitt, of course, is now jockeying to join the Trump administration. He wants to be Secretary of State. He's going to dinner with Trump. And check out the stuff he's saying about Trump now. Quote, Trump won the general election and he continues with a message of inclusion and bringing people together. And Romney spoke about that dinner he had with Trump this week, saying, quote, I had a wonderful evening with President-elect Trump. We had another discussion about affairs throughout the world, and these discussions I've had with him have been enlightening and interesting and engaging. I've enjoyed them very, very much. Didn't exactly look like he was enjoying himself, by the way, if you saw that picture of the two of them.
No, it didn't.
Romney said he had, quote, increasing hope that President-elect Trump is the very man who can lead us to that better future. You know, I can't even stomach much more of this. Let's just get on with it. I'm done with this garbage can. Mitt Romney,
Whoa, wait. I'm sympathetic to this idea. I mean, Mittens is clearly very worthy of a can, but damn it, we have seven more candidates to get to.
All right.
They've earned their nomination.
They have earned their nomination. They deserve the airing of their nomination. Yeah, I'm sorry. I got ahead of myself. Mitt has really burned me up. All right, Sam. Well, who else is nominated?
They worked very long and hard to get to this point, so yes, Let's give them their due. We've got garbage candidate number two, Corey Lewandowski. I'm fairly certain we've nominated Corey for the can before.
Multiple times.
I think we may have even
thrown him in.
Yeah, I think we may have even thrown the greasy buzz cut in the damn can. Either way, he's a top garbage candidate this week. Lewandowski was a regular post-election symposium at Harvard on Thursday with operatives from the Clinton campaign, and I'll just get right into it. He had this to say: "We've had one of the top people at the New York Times come to Harvard University and say, I'm willing to go to jail to get a copy of Donald Trump's taxes so I can publish them. Dean Baquet, he came here, offered to go to jail. You're telling me he's willing to commit a felony on a private citizen to post his taxes, and there isn't enough scrutiny on the Trump campaign and his business dealings and his taxes?
Private citizen?
Yeah. It's egregious," Lewandowski continued. "He should be in jail." Wow. Okay. Yeah. I mean, funny on the subject of journalism and people who should be in jail. Corey, for one, for manhandling former Breitbart reporter Michelle Fields as she tried to ask Trump a question. Of course, Lewandowski was not prosecuted, with local DAs in Florida saying they couldn't argue beyond reasonable doubt that Lewandowski committed battery. Of course, it also helps that a thuggish black shirt wannabe like Lewandowski constantly bends over backwards to rhetorically fillet cops. Daily Caller reporter assaulted by NYPD during Occupy protests? Professional reporting or attention seeking is what Lewandowski tweeted in a bid to defame Fields. After the event, she's probably the only member of the right-wing media you'll ever hear me defend on the show. "You are totally delusional," is what he also tweeted at Fields in March shortly after the incident. "I never touched you. As a matter of fact, I have never even met you." Video, of course, soon proved Corey was lying through his teeth. Ironically, if Trump loosened libel laws like he said he wanted to on the campaign to target the New York Times, that would open up Lewandowski to serious litigation risk here. "I have never even met you. I never touched you. You're totally delusional." Jesus. I mean, not that it matters to Corey or the mess of crap that is his scummy boss. Nothing really matters to them except, the advancement of their agenda, obviously. Anyway, someone who deserves to have his tax documents and every other sensitive piece of information about his business activities splashed all over the headlines is, in fact, Donald Trump. To reduce him to a private citizen is insane. Dean Baquet doesn't belong in jail for wanting to publish what should be public information. Corey Lewandowski, however, I'm not willing to disqualify him from deserving to rot in a cell. Either way, this week, Corey, you could get the garbage can.
Yeah, I'm actually glad you stopped me from throwing Mitt Romney in the garbage can so quickly, because Corey Lewandowski clearly deserves it as well. And the whole private citizen business, that's what really gets... This is a celebrity... A reality TV star,
a guy
who is running for president of the United States, a guy who is now the president-elect of the United States. What kind of moron do you have to be to describe Donald Trump as a private citizen?
I don't know, but whatever position Corey gets from Trump is going to be way above his pay grade. He deserves to be in the damn can.
Yes, agreed. All right, garbage candidate number three, Craig Timberg. Now, Timberg is a bad journalist was cut down in the woods. Would anybody hear it? Timberg is the Washington Post journalist behind that god-awful Proper Not story we've been chatting about all week. You know, the story that gave an anonymous group of so-called researchers calling themselves Proper Not a platform to promote their media blacklist of outlets that they claim are part of a Russian disinformation network. Of course, it turned out that many, if not most, of the outlets on the list have absolutely nothing to do with Russia, and a lot of them are pretty decent left-wing independent news outlets that were just smeared. Timberg hasn't even attempted to defend his story either. He's referred all questions about it to the Washington Post, won't speak about it at all. Over at the New Yorker, Adrian Chen writes this about his experience with Proper Not. Chen says that reporting on internet phenomenon, one learns to be wary of anonymous collectives freely offering the fruits of their research. I told Proper Not that I was probably too busy to write a story, but I asked to see the report. In reply, Proper Not asked me to put the group in touch with folks at the New York Times, WAPO, Wall Street Journal, and anyone else who you think would be interested. Deep in the middle of another project, I never followed up, end quote, is what Adrian Chen said. Well, Chen didn't get duped by the Proper Not folks, but Timberg did. Clearly, the Proper Not got in touch with the Washington Post. Timberg bought their story and in the process trashed all of his journalistic standards, and the Washington Post thoroughly embarrassed itself. So, Mr. Timberg, I have the perfect place for you to continue your investigations of fake news. It's right here in our garbage can. There's tons of fake news in it.
Garbage candidate number four, Martin Shkreli.
What, Shkreli, what is this, 2015? Come on.
Okay, but I know Martin Shkreli is a sociopathic attention seeker and probably should be ignored, but we're going to give him the garbage can spotlight because he got owned by a bunch of kids. He got owned by children. Well, you know, teenagers, whatever. 11 students at a grammar school in Sydney, Australia, decided to make Daraprim, the anti-malaria drug, at the center of the Shkreli controversy. Of course, Shkreli was the founder and CEO of Turing Pharmaceuticals, a company that bought rights to the drug and jacked up its price to $750 per pill, justifying it as part of the cost of making medicine. Got to get it to market somehow, right? Mm. And so these kids set out to prove what a liar is, and so they made it in their chemistry class for $2 a pop. Of course, Shkreli tried to play this off with his smug, smartest, realest guy in the room shtick, responding to people who were subtweeting him by posting the story. LOL, how is that showing anyone up? He smirked. Almost any drug can be made at a small scale for a low price. Glad it makes you feel good, though.
Shkreli clearly not mad online there.
Of course, what Shkreli didn't tweet about, he was able to jack up the price and literally extract blood from dying people due to our broken beyond repair patent system. It has nothing to do with large-scale drug manufacturing. As a university professor who worked with the kids pointed out, quote, while the drug is still out of patent, Turing Pharmaceuticals controls its distribution and sale in the United States through a loophole called the closed distribution model. She also noted in response to Shkreli's thinly veiled tantrum about drug making being so simple, quote, if anyone can do it and it's so cheap, it highlights why it shouldn't be $750 a dose.
Yes.
Indeed it does, which is why Martin Shkreli could get the immortal technique treatment and be put into the garbage can inside of a high school.
With Lynn Miranda.
Yeah. Although, you know, I mean, maybe we should go a little easy on Hamilton, just vis-a-vis yes. Martin Shkreli. I don't know.
Yes. Well, I was just making immortal
technique. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that's true. And that was also good and cool, the immortal technique.
Shkreli, man. Shkreli getting mad online at teenagers. Okay, moving on. Garbage candidate number five, Eric Bollert. Liberals like Eric have spent the past few weeks since the election deflecting blame for Hillary Clinton's election loss onto everyone and everything other than the candidate herself. He's sent off a few tweets attacking Bernie Sanders, suggesting Bernie Sanders might be a white supremacist because Bernie challenged Trump on the infrastructure bill, saying he'd actually work with Trump if Trump was actually serious about passing a massive infrastructure bill. Anyways, it's fine that Bollert wants to defend Clinton. It's what you'd expect from someone like Bollert, who works at an organization like Media Matters, an organization devoted to exposing right-wing lies, but only right-wing lies. It runs cover for liberals who also lie and support bad policies, including Hillary Clinton. Bollert is a partisan commentator who would go out of his way to protect Clinton from criticism. And again, this is fine. That's Bollert. I don't have a problem with him. That's fine. But here's what ticked me off about all this. All right, we all know the Trump Carrier story by now. Vice President-elect Mike Pence basically bribed Carrier for them to keep half the jobs that they were planning to outsource to Mexico to keep them in his state of Indiana. Well, Trump had a rally at the Carrier plant this week to promote all of this. And there was a local reporter who was denied entry to that building. His name was Rafael Sanchez. Sanchez had been critically reporting on Carrier since they first announced plans to move jobs to Mexico. And the company wouldn't let him in the building for the Trump speech, probably because of his reporting. The company would not let Rafael Sanchez in the building. So Sanchez stood outside the building, filed his own video report detailing what was happening, and said he will continue to report on Carrier no matter if they try to deny him access. So that's good. Good on Mr. Sanchez. He's a good reporter. Bollert, here's what he reacted to that. He issued this tweet linking to Sanchez's report and said, quote, DC press could learn from this guy. Again, Bollert has no right to lecture the DC press on anything. After all, he's one of the guys who claimed that the DC press was too hard on his candidate Hillary Clinton during the election. The only reason he likes Mr. Sanchez is because Mr. Sanchez was reporting critically on Trump and Carrier. So it's clear Bollert thinks that good journalism is something that only harms political candidates he opposes. And that, to me, is worthy of a trip to the garbage can.
Weird, I just got a text from a friend who claims that Mitt Romney is one of my alts. Put me in the garbage can.
Okay.
Maybe we will. Maybe we will. Anyway, garbage candidate number 6, 20 House Democrats. So last night, the House of Representatives quietly passed a bill that would eliminate a Dodd-Frank provision that subjects massive banks to more strict supervision. H.R. 6392, the legislation pushed by House Financial Services Committee lizard Blaine Lutkemeyer, would repeal the $50 billion threshold that triggers banks' considerations for systemically important financial institution status, which is a linchpin of the financial reforms that were passed since the huge crisis of 2008. Remember that? Remember the huge crisis of 2008?
Yes.
When the entire world economy collapsed? Anyway, so the bill has little chances of getting the 60 votes it currently needs to pass the Senate and might not even get that many in the Senate under Trump. You know, who knows how things will – how the chips will fall on a vote like that. Nonetheless, 20 Democrats were cool with this proposal and voted for it. Their rejection wouldn't have flipped the final result, but either way, it shows there are plenty of Wall Street butt-kissing Dems who seem ready to side with Trump and the reptilians over in the Manhattan financial sector. When called upon, they will probably do it. Here are their names: Brad Ashford, Joyce Betty, Sanford Bishop, Jim Cooper, Jim Costa, Henry Cuellar, John Delaney, Gene Green, Brian Higgins, Sheila Jackson Lee, Dan Lipinski, Gregory Meeks, Patrick Murphy, Donald Payne, Scott Peters, Colin Peterson, David Scott, Terry Sewell, Kristen Sinema, and Albio Cires. Mm. So if you are one of their constituents, you might want to have a word. Why are Democrats rushing to do favors for Wall Street before Trump even takes over? Maybe because it's in the party's blood. Maybe that's why Hillary Clinton lost last month. I don't know. It is why the two Sams might have to take out the trash, though, by nominating these 20 Dems. Got to clean up the Democratic Party, got to take out the trash. So yeah, these 20 Dems might be going in the garbage can. Seriously, you're one of their, if you are one of their constituents, feel free to call their office and let them know that the two Sams nominated them for the damn can.
Yes, please do that.
Let us know how that goes, by the way.
All right, garbage candidate number 7, the House Science Committee. When a political party that fundamentally does not believe in science, like Republicans, is in charge of something called the House Science Committee, then you'd expect hilarity to ensue. And sure enough, it has. And by hilarity, I mean cringe-inducing tweets that remind you that the future of our planet hinges on a bunch of dumb geriatric Republicans chairing a congressional committee. Yes, the House Science Committee's official Twitter account on Thursday tweeted out a link to a Breitbart article. And not just any Breitbart article, a Breitbart article that was, of course, doubting global warming. The article noted a short-term dip in global land temperatures as evidence that long-term global warming trends are completely bogus. The old, it's cold outside, so global warming is a hoax type of argument.
Yeah, the Jim Inhofe throwing a snowball on the Senate floor.
Yes, yes. The House Science Committee, led by the GOP, tweeted out the article along with the headline that read, "Global temperatures plunge, icy silence from climate alarmists." Now, the committee would have a good shot at ending up in the garbage can this week if not for Bernie Sanders, who took it upon himself to thoroughly own them and owning that might spare the committee from the garbage can due to served owning time. Bernie responded to the tweet saying, quote, where'd you get your PhD? Trump University? That's a good one. And it's topical, Bernie. Well done. But seriously, these are the folks we're supposed to rely on to pass legislation that saves us from global warming-induced catastrophe? We're doomed. Maybe you should be the ones jumping into the garbage can for refuge ourselves. All right. Those are your candidates. We've got seven of them. The House Science Committee. We've got 20
Romney.
House Democrats. Shkreli. Craig Timberg.
Corey Lewandowski.
All right. I want Romney.
You want Romney? I kind of want the 20 House Dems. But Corey Lewandowski could be good. Romney could be good.
Let's throw Romney in. Come on. He's bad.
Okay.
We've thrown in Lewandowski before.
All right. You're definitely right about, like...
Let me do it.
Okay, go ahead.
Mitt Romney, you are going in the garbage can. There it is, Mitt.
Right next to the Romney Ryan sign.
I hope he changed out of his nice suit and just put on his magical underwear for that garbage tossing.
Dog Seamus is in there.
Oh,
poor Seamus.
You've been reunited with Seamus, Mitt. Enjoy it.
This time, maybe you'll be the one who'll be strapped to the roof.
Maybe.
But he's got to be inside the garbage can. Sorry, Seamus, you might be going back on the roof.
That'll do it for Unanimous Dissent today. And this week, you can listen to this show and all of our shows by going to the Radio Sputnik website or by checking out our website at www.districtsentinel.com. Subscribe to this show on iTunes by searching for District Sentinel Radio. You'll have the show downloaded to your phone every day or your iPad or whatever. Stick around for next week's slate of shows. We're not going anywhere. We'll stay here in D.C., so you don't have to be.